WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. 2 years ago, Frank McCourt's memoir, Angela's Ashes, introduced millions of readers to the McCourt family of Limerick, Ireland. Now Frank's younger brother, the character actor Malachy McCourt, has written a book which takes up the saga where his brother left off. Amongst Swimming is about Malachy's first decade in New York, where he arrived in 1952 after Frank paid his passage. He quickly developed a reputation as someone who could outdrink anyone on a dare. He also began an acting career as a member of the New York ensemble group, the Irish Players. He became an instant personality when he appeared repeatedly and often drunk on the Jack Parr Show. And he ran a couple of infamous bars. When Malachy McCourt was growing up, poor and often hungry in Limerick, his dreams of life in America were based on westerns, Mickey Rooney movies, and gangster films.
One of my ambitions was to grow up and come to America and become an American convict, because they had a nice little cell, these convicts, all to themselves, and they had a bed with a pillow and clean sheets and a blanket, and they had a toilet that was indoors. They had shoes, and they had a uniform, gray uniform, with their name on the above the lapel. But you got three meals a day. I would pretend I didn't like it, because everybody else wouldn't like the prison food, but I would think it was magnificent stuff, from what I saw anyway, from my vantage point. And then the warden's wife, warden's daughter would come around to see how dreadful things were, and she would talk to me about it, and I would tell her, and then we would go and tell the warden, and he would say, oh, my God, I didn't know such awful things existed in my prison. And he would rectify the whole thing, reform the prison, and I then would marry the daughter and become the assistant warden, despite my criminal record.
What did you do when you first landed here in New York to support yourself?
I got off the ship, the good ship America, and I'd met some people on the boat, and they got me a job as a dishwasher in a hospital on what was known then as Welfare Island, which is now Roosevelt Island, where there's a rather nice housing on there. So I entered the Stygian darkness of a kitchen of a hospital and washed dishes, and that was my beginning. Then I worked as a longshoreman, and then I worked as a truck loader in New Jersey. I worked as a concrete inspector on the Jersey Turnpike. So, and then I walked into a theater and I saw a play by John Millington Synge, and I thought, wouldn't it be grand to be an actor? And I walked out of there on floating on air from the wonderful words of John Millington Synge. And then I made a 180-degree turn, went back into the theater and asked the man if I could join his group. And that's how I thought you did it. I didn't know about auditions and things. So they asked me to read. Somebody was leaving the cast, and I got the part. And then I got on the, as a result of that sort of odd way of getting a job as an actor, I got on The Tonight Show and various other shows, and then somebody offered me a job as a bartender, and then shortly after that, somebody financed me in a saloon of my own. And there it was. This guy just stepped off a ship with $4. I had $4 in my pocket, and I, all of a sudden, I was on top of the world.
You and some other friends started a bar around this time called Malachy's, appropriately, and you claim it as the first singles bar. Did you actually set out to make it a singles bar? Because they didn't exist then, right?
No, they didn't exist, but it was inadvertent that it came about. We bought this hole in the wall, or the two other guys, Hal Kemp and Roland Martinez, who the ones were my partners. They gave me a percentage, a 20% a portion of the business. There was a tradition on Third Avenue. It was lined with Irish saloons with green fluorescent shamrocks and all that kind of old fake Irish green ghetto rubbish. All up and down the place. The Sure and Begala Brigades, as I called them, were in full flight then. But I didn't like that kind of thing. And it was a tradition that women did not sit at the bar. And everybody thought it was a law. And I researched it and found out it was just simply tradition that the women sat away from the bar. So I said, well, we're going to change that one. And much to the consternation of the old-timers and who used to battle in there, and some police thought it was the... Because the idea was that a woman wouldn't sit at the bar unless she was about to sell her body for money or for drink. Can you imagine that kind of ancient macho sexism that existed even up to quite recently, really? Anyway, there was a hotel around the corner called the Barbizon Hotel for Women, and some of these actors who were doing shows on Broadway, like people like Burton and O'Toole and Courtney and Tom Courtney and the Brits, Alan Bates and these lads, he was doing Look Back in Anger, and they started wandering in, Richard Harris, and then the young things heard. So that's how it became famous.
What kind of drinker were you? Did you... And by that, I mean, over a typical night, did you go through predictable stages? The witty stage, and then the uproarious stage, then weepy?
Well, one of the things that people have said was that they never saw me drunk. So I consumed large quantities of Irish whiskey. And I was one of those people that did not stutter or mumble or stumble or fall. And never seemed to lose control. And that's a very dangerous kind of drinker, because nobody knows that you are drunk, and they keep buying you drinks. And I wouldn't know I was drunk either. And then in the morning, I wouldn't know where I was, who I was going to wake up with, and who I had insulted the night before, or what dreadful thing I'd done, where I was. And that led to a great deal of trouble in my life, which I haven't had now for about 14 years of sobriety, thanks be.
You got married pretty young, your 20s, right? And you rather quickly had a child, a daughter. And you write that the night she was born, you went on a bender for 4 days. When you weren't drinking, were you actually supporting your family and functioning and holding down a job?
When I was in the bar business, Yeah, I was the breadwinner, as they say. But Linda, my then wife, she was from a rather well-to-do family, and they lived on Park Avenue and all that. And they were subsidizing Linda, and of course, because there were times when I wasn't around, and then there was babies, Siobhan, my daughter who lives in Boston, and young Malachi who lives in Bali right now. And he's a diver. So I was very much an absent husband, and following in the mythical steps of my own father, who had deserted us when we were children. But of course, alcoholism being a disease that tells you you don't have a disease, and it afflicts a whole family, told me that, you know, you're just having fun. And that I was, and I was not faithful, and I was not diligent about familial responsibilities. But I had my only explanation, I have no excuse for it, is that I had no role models for family life or for responsible male behavior. So I wasn't, I was not a good husband. And when I got married at 25, it wasn't a young age to get married, really. But it was very young for me, because I was just barely an adolescent in my head. And indeed, when you're drinking, you stop maturing when you have an addiction problem. You stop the maturing process. So I had stopped. And it's only lately that I've begun to mature.
After your marriage ended, you lost custody of your two children. It was a pretty desperate time for you. You took up an offer to be a courier for a gold smuggler.
Yes.
Now, how did your part of the operation work?
Well, I would meet my contact in Zurich, and I would check into one of those. Do you know they have all over Zurich? They had temperance hotels. I would arrive fluttered, and I'd bring in all this whiskey. And so my man, my contact, the gold man, would bring over the gold bars. There were 20 kilos, and put them in a kind of a body corset type of thing with lots of pockets. And I would go from Zurich to Rome, and then take whatever airline there might be going from there, whether it's Indian Airlines or might be Alitalia or one of the American ones. And I would meet my contact in Bombay. And many times the first times that was disastrous because there were so many misunderstandings and I was left, as they say, holding the gold. But I finally did manage to deliver it. But I made about 6 deliveries traveling the length and breadth of India.
You strapped 20 kilos of gold to your chest? Wasn't it hard to move? How could you bend down?
You couldn't. I once remember we stopped, the plane stopped in Bahrain, and we had to get off, disembark, and I got down. And the journey across we had to go across the tarmac and into the terminal building that night. And so I was, by the time I got in there, I was bathed in perspiration because the temperature outside was about 190 degrees or something. So I got in, and I was desperately looking for a water fountain, and I saw one. And I went over rather rapidly, and I bent over to drink. And I, being top-heavy, I was like the Lusitania. Over I went and collapsed on the floor. And I could barely get up. But I was looking at a row of seats of Tuareg-type Arabs with their turbans and all, about 8 or 9, all looking at me. Those lads wear veils. And they were looking with the very sharp, steely-eyed, what is this idiot doing collapsed on the floor over a drink of water? And I got myself up, and there was a hint of amusement in one of their eyes. So I bowed to him, and he politely applauded me for getting on my feet again.
My guest is Malachim McCourt. He's appeared in a number of movies, including Devil's Own, She's the One, Bonfire of the Vanities, Green Card and The Field. He's also acted for years on the stage in New York. He has a new memoir called A Monk Swimming. It's about his first years living in America in the 50s, the early 60s. We're going to take a break now, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with actor Malachim McCourt. His new memoir is A Monk Swimming. It's so hard to understand, but so obvious at the same time. Your father drank, and his drinking had such a ruinous effect on your family and your childhood. He drank away the family's money. He couldn't hold a job. 3 of your siblings died from disease and malnutrition, and he abandoned your family. Do you think of your drinking at the time that you thought of it as something different, that what you made of your life was something completely and entirely different from your father's legacy?
Well, I suffered from the delusion that I was present. But of course, being physically present, which I was a lot of the times, is different from being spiritually and responsibly present. And so there it was. I didn't know. I did not know, and I ought to have. I'm a pretty intelligent kind of a fellow, but I wasn't raised in a kind of self-analysis department. And as they say today, you know, we're all from dysfunctional families, and I came from a dysfunctional family. But I would have said a dysfunctional family where I grew up was a family that could afford to drink but didn't. And the rest of us thought it was a release. Brendan Behan said that, you know, to get enough to eat was an accomplishment. To get drunk was a victory. So we had all this romanticism about it. And yet the reality of it was that the suffering that people endured under the alcohol and the beatings, you know, there was a lot of tremendous amount of wife abuse and spousal abuse and children abuse, child abuse. There was both physical and sexual, as well as the spiritual abuses that went on, all of which was considered, well, it's a strong man's failing. Ah, he's just fond of the drop. It was always excused. So that was that cultural thing then. And I'm glad to say that's all changing.
So when did you stop drinking?
I stopped about 14 years ago. I found myself, although Diana and I have been married now for 33 years, and I drank for a lot of about 19 years of our marriage, but not the same kind of drinking as I'd done. I'd learned some kind of a lesson, but I was still not aware of the fact that I was alcoholic. So and she stuck with me. And then it dawned on me. I started sinking into a very deep depression. And I understood. Diane is an extraordinarily intelligent, insightful woman and filled with love and compassion and decency. And she never nagged me about it. She just said, well, I knew one day you would know, and I do. I hope I do anyway. So I'm a recovering alcoholic now, and I'm a loving husband and a loving father, loving grandfather. And I'm a vegetarian, and I don't drink coffee, and I give up cigarettes, and I'm just waiting for the call to go from I'll be the only saint canonized while I'm alive. And then all these good things have happened, you know, Frank writing his book and me in sobriety being able to write this book. And it's some people don't like it, and they're all looking for Angela's ashes. They're telling me what I am not. I'm not Frank McCourt, and it's not Angela's ashes. You're damn right it isn't. That couldn't be written. That was written by a classic man, a classic work by a classic man who is much more generous and non-judgmental than I am. But there it be. I wrote mine.
Did you consciously not write about your childhood because you felt that your brother Frank had pretty much cornered that?
No, he
had
didn't
covered
corner
that
it.
Story.
He wrote it, and there was nothing I could add to it. The only thing I would have disputed to him was that I was not that angelic little fellow that he talked about. I had murder in my heart most of the time, and I was manipulative, and I was conniving, cunning, cute little bugger. And I maneuvered people into doing what I wanted them to do because I had those looks and that gift, whatever it is, and of persuasion and of charm. It took me a long time to realize that they were gifts, and I used them the wrong way.
I think your brother tells a story that they used to make you go around to people's houses essentially to beg for food or for money because
oh, sure.
You were so pretty with the...
Oh, I was gorgeous. There's a story that some rich lady wanted to adopt me. She stopped in this limousine and a Daimler and a chauffeur got out and she said that I was gorgeous and told my mother she would pay any amount of money. And my mother thought and thought and thought, but then she said, well, she would know how to explain it to my father if she had sold me on the street. That is the story. Frank likes to tell it that way.
Do you think then that your good looks as a child changed somewhat how you perceive the poverty of your family and of your childhood, the reality of it, because you could charm people so well? Do you think things didn't seem as dire to you?
Oh, they seem dire to me. They seem dire to me. But at the same time, I was able to subconsciously adopt the day-to-time situation. So I lived a day-to-time, and whatever I got now was just fine. And if we lived, you see, when you see the kids die, your sister and your two brothers, and the 11 classmates of ours that died, you look around and you feel, well, it starts off, you know, with somebody's nose running and then they have a cough and then they start throwing up or something and then they don't come to school and the next thing they're dead. So your nose starts running and you get a bit of a cough and you think, oh, this is it for me. So you better enjoy the day. So we were constantly aware of death, unlike here when it's concealed. People don't die here, as we know. They pass away, they pass on. Death is death, and we were aware of that. There's a sort of permanence about it, and you got that very early in life. So the thing was that any day above ground now is a good one for me. It's a great one, and I appreciate it. And so I live it now much better than I did then, even though I was aware of the day-to-time situation subconsciously.
Writing about this period in your life, a lot of it is really hilarious, but a lot is particularly about your first wife and where your children are concerned, was pretty destructive and ugly stuff. Writing about it, has it given you a different perspective on the person you were then?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's that's old stuff, and but you're as sick as your secrets, families and people. So the thing is that, well, all right, let it out there. And you're right, it was ugly, and it was rotten, and I was not a very nice human being. So writing about it, is anybody interested in whether I was or not? I really don't know. But I have written it, and so be it, and there it is. And if people want to read about it, and I just hope it helps other folks. That's what I do hope. There isn't much in this portion of my life. It's a decade when I intend to write some more. And I don't want to get into a mea culpa situation, but there is recovery in my life. There is joy, and there's a lot of love now, and I'm very grateful for that. I'm overflowing with it.
Malachy McCourt, thank you so much for talking with me today.
It was a great pleasure, Barbara. Thank you.
Malachy McCourt's memoir is A Monk Swimming.